Lecture S-19, December 6, 1962, The Principle of Least Action.
We interrupt our series of lectures on Maxwell's equations and so on to discuss a small other item so that you can study the other ones for the examination. When I was in high school, my physics teacher, whose name was a Mr. Bader, B-A-D-E-R, called me down after one class and said, "You look bored," he said, in the physics class. He said, "I'm going to tell you something interesting." And then he told me something which I found absolutely fascinating and have since always found fascinating, and always, every time the subject comes up, I do work on it. In fact, when I went to prepare this lecture, I found myself making more analyses on the thing because I couldn't worry about the lecture but worried about the subject too much. And this is the principle of least action. He told me the following thing. That if you have a particle, say, you know, in a gravitational field, for instance, which starts here and moves, say, to some other point by free motion, you throw it and it goes up and comes to here, that to go from the original place to the final place in a certain amount, it goes from the original place to the final place a certain amount of time. You throw it up, it comes down to here. Now, you try a different motion. Suppose to get from here to there in the same amount of time, it went like this, but got there at just the right time. Then he says this, that you calculate the kinetic energy, take away the potential energy at every moment in the path, and integrate over the whole path during the time, you'll find that that number you'll get is bigger than it is for the actual motion. In other words, the laws of Newton could be stated not as a form F equals ma, but in the form that the average kinetic energy less the average potential energy is as little as possible. That's all for a path going from one point to another. Let me illustrate a little bit better what it means. If we take the case of the gravitational field, then if the particle has a position x, a vertical height, let's just take one dimension for a moment. It just goes up and down and not sideways. Then here's the kinetic energy. If x of t is the path and the potential energy at any time is mgx, if x is the height above the ground. Now I take the kinetic energy minus the potential energy at every moment along the path and integrate that with respect to time from the initial time to the final time, and suppose that the paths that I'm talking about have this property. Let x be the height above the ground as a function of time. And let's suppose that at the original time t1, we started at some height, and at the end of the time t2, we are definitely ending at some other place. The actual motion is some kind of a curve. It's a parabola it goes up and down, but if you stretch out the time, it's a parabola. Well, we could imagine that other motion, that it went very high and came up and down and then fiddled around and go tsk, 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 boom. Well, we can calculate the kinetic energy and minus the potential energy for the other, for any path we want. And the miracle is that the true path is the one for which that integral is least. All right, let's try it out. First, suppose we take a case of a free particle for which there's no potential energy at all. Then it says that in going from one point to another in a given amount of time, the kinetic energy integral is least if it goes at a uniform speed. We know that's the answer, to go at a uniform speed. Now, why is that? Because if the particle were to go any other way, the velocities would be higher and lower than the average sometimes. I mean, if it didn't go at a constant velocity, then sometimes it's high and sometimes it's lower than the average. The average velocity is the same for every case because we have to get from here to here in a given amount of time. That is, your job is, for instance, to start from home and get to school in a given length of time with the car. And you can do it several ways. You can accelerate like mad at the beginning and slow down with the brakes at the end, or you can go at a uniform speed, or you can start and go backwards for a while and come forward and so on. And the thing is, if you'll take this, the average speed, the average velocity, it's got to be, of course, the total distance that you've gone over the time. But if you do anything but go at a uniform speed, then sometimes you're going too fast and sometimes you're going too slow. And the mean square of something which deviates around an average, as you well know, is positive. It's always greater. The mean square of something that's fluctuating is higher than the square of the mean. And so the kinetic energy integral would be too high, would be always higher if you wobbled your velocity than if you went at a uniform velocity in a straight line. So we see that the best thing to do if the problem has no forces on it is to just go in a straight line. That to, for instance, speed up at the beginning, to pick up a little bit of, go up a little bit too fast and then come down, would involve a higher mean kinetic energy. Now, in fact, of course, an object does, in falling, does rise faster and slow up, and does do more like this. But that's because it's not free, but there's also the potential energy, and let's see how that works. If there were no potential energy, then the best path is the one here. To take another one is to use more kinetic energy. On the other hand, because the potential energy rises as we go up in space, you know, we'll get a lower difference if we can use some of that, if we can get up into the high potential energy, because then we can take that potential away from the kinetic energy and get a gain. So it's better to take a path which goes up and gets a lot of minus signs from the kinetic from the potential energy. On the other hand, you can't go up too fast and too far because you'll have too much kinetic energy involved. You have to go very fast to get way up and to come down again in the short time available. So you don't want to go too far up, but you want to go up some. And so it turns out that the solution is some kind of a balance between these matters of trying to get a least amount of kinetic energy and, I mean, well, trying to get the difference, the kinetic, like away the potential, as small as possible. And so the body starts a little faster than normal and slows up near the end rather than going at uniform velocity in an extra potential. That's all that my teacher told me, because he was a very good teacher and knew when to stop talking. But I don't know when to stop talking. And I make the mistake of telling you too much. And so I'm going to continue with that vein of always telling you too much. So instead of leaving it in an interesting form, I'm going to horrify and disgust you with the complexities of life by proving it. The kind of mathematical problem that we have is very difficult and new kind. We have a certain quantity which is called the action. And in a one-dimensional problem will be the kinetic energy take away the potential energy, integrated over time. Remember that this x is a function of time. This is the x as a function of time. I didn't put x as a function of time in, but it is. And for each different path, you get a different number for this. So we have a kind of a mathematical problem. We have a way of calculating a number, the action, a certain integral. And for every curve, there's a number. And the problem is to find out for what curve that number is the least. You say, oh, that's just a ordinary calculus of maximum minima. You calculate it for, and you just have to differentiate to find the maximum. But watch out. Ordinarily, we have just a function that we have to find the value of some number in the. We have a function which, like, as for example, I don't know. For ordinary maximum minimum problem, we have an example where we have just a number associated, for instance, let's suppose we have a rod which has been heated in the middle and the heat is spread around. And it's just a one-dimensional rod. And we want to know where the temperature is largest. Then the situation is this. For each point on the rod, we have a temperature. But we must find the point at which the temperature is largest. Here, for each path in space, we have a number, quite a different thing. and we have to find the path in space for which the number is a maximum. That's a completely different branch of mathematics. It's not the ordinary calculus. In fact, it's called the calculus of variations, to give it a new number, a new name. There are many problems in this kind of mathematics. For example, the circle is the curve, of course, whose locus of all points is constant distance from us, another point. But another way of defining a circle is of this kind is this. A circle is that curve of given length which encloses the biggest area. Any other curve encloses less area for a given perimeter than the circle. So if we put the problem, find that curve which encloses the greatest area for a given perimeter, then we would have a problem of the calculus of variations, a different kind of calculus than you're used to. So we make the calculation. Now here's the way we're going to do it. The idea is that if the red line here represents the true path, and the white line represents any other path, that if we calculate the action S for the white line, we'll get a value that's bigger than if we calculate it for the red line. Problem, find the red line. I mean, where is it? So one way, of course, is to calculate the action for millions and millions of these paths and find them out on an adding machine and look at which one is lowest. And when you've got the lowest one, that's this path. That's possible, but we can do it better than that. We'll do it in the following way. First, in an ordinary sense, when we have a quantity which is a minimum, for instance, in an ordinary function or a maximum like the temperature, one of the properties of the maximum is that if we go away from the maximum in first order, the deviation away from the maximum is only second order. Any place else on the curve, if we move a distance but first order, the value of the curve function changes also in the first order. But at the maximum, a tiny motion away makes in first approximation no difference. And that's what we're going to use to calculate this. If this is the maximum or minimum, in our case a minimum, then a curve which differs a little bit from this curve will in first approximation make no difference. The errors will be in second approximation. Then it's a maximum. I prove it to you. Because if there was a correction in first order, when I deviated the curve a certain way, there was a change in the action which was proportional to the deviation. Let's suppose that that change made it greater. If it made it less, we know we haven't got a minimum. But then taking the change with that opposite sign, since it was a first order effect, the results are proportional to this change. If we take the change with the opposite sign, then we would get the thing to decrease. If it increased one way, it would decrease the other way. The only way it could really be a maximum is that in first approximation, it doesn't make any difference. And that the deviations are proportional to the square, so that when we move on either side, it goes up both ways. So, okay, so the principle, therefore, is this, that if we take a path x of t, which differs from the true path, I'm going to call x with an underline the true path, the red path that we're trying to find. And our trial path, x, differs from this path by a small amount, which we call eta of t, and which is drawn on here as the difference in the two paths. Now the idea is that if we calculate the S for the path X, then the difference between that S and the S that we calculated before for the path X bar, I just simplified the writing with all the S sub bar, where you put X bar in here and calculate the red value. The difference of these two things must be zero in the first order approximation to eta. It can be different in the second order, but only in the first order must be zero. That's the problem. And that must be true for any eta at all. Well, not quite. Such that the etas at the ends are zero. Because one of the conditions of the thing doesn't mean anything unless you consider paths which begin and end at the same places. I mean, at the same place, all the paths end and begin at the same. Each path begins at a certain point and ends at a certain point. Those points are kept fixed, both in position and time. It has to start somewhere and end in the same place. So our eta, the deviations, are zero at each end. And that's the mathematical problem. It would be, if I were trying to do calculus, analogous to this, that I start to discuss what happens if you take f of x and add a small amount h to it, and argue that the correction to f of x is of the first order, the first order correction is zero. And we're going to calculate this thing by actually calculating the first order difference. It's just like trying to expand this function out to first order and h. It's the analog of differentiation, but we'll just do it directly by making a substitution. So the general idea then is this. I take, to put the x equal x bar plus eta, and I substitute in the formula for the action. You see, if x is equal to x bar plus eta, then the derivative of x, of course, is the derivative of x bar plus the derivative of eta. So putting that in here for the action, I get this expression, which is just the same formula, but with x substituted. Now, well, I must write this out in more detail. I square this thing, and I get m over 2 times the square of the first term. Just a minute here. And then I get a cross term, m dx dt d eta dt. And then I get a term m over 2 times d eta dt square. But wait, I'm not worrying about higher than the first order. So I take all the terms which involve eta square and beyond, and put them in a little box called second and higher order. In this case, only second, but there'll be more from something else over here. Now we need the potential V at x bar plus eta. And I consider eta small, and I can easily expand that. First, if the eta was 0, I get V of x, which I happen to have written over here. And then in the next approximation, from the ordinary nature of derivatives, the correction is the rate of change of V with respect to x times eta. I've written V prime for the derivative of V with respect to x to save writing. So that the next term in here is the beginning of a Taylor series in which we have V of x bar plus eta times the first derivative plus eta squared times the second derivative plus eta cubed plus the third derivative. All that other stuff falling into the second and higher order category, and we don't have to worry about it. Okay, now if we look carefully at the thing, we see, of course, that if we forgot about the eta's terms altogether, naturally, it's the same as putting in x bar, and that the first two terms which I've arranged here corresponds to the action that I would have calculated with the ordinary, with the true path x bar, which I'll call s bar. And that the thing that I want to concentrate on, of course, is the change in the s, the difference between the s and the s that we would get for the right path. This difference sometimes is, we write it, say, delta s, a difference in s. And I've just brought down the two terms here and left out all the higher order terms, so I'm up to here. Now, the game is this. Problem. Here's a certain integral. I don't know what the x bar is yet, but I know this. There's no eta bar, that's not it. I know this, that no matter what eta is, this integral must be zero. No matter what eta is, you think, oh, well, the only way that could happen is that the thing that's in front of the eta, and if it's true that this integral is zero for all eta, that this thing must be zero. But wait about this. Well, after all, if eta is anything, its derivative is anything also, so you conclude that both of these must be zero. That isn't quite right. That isn't quite right because there's a connection between eta and its derivative, and that they're not absolutely independent. The method of solving all of these problems in this calculus of variations, in fact, the calculus of variations, consists of first making a shift. There are formulas in the work that tell you how to do this without actually calculating anything, but they're no good. The right way to do it is to calculate it this way. You make the shift in the thing you want to vary. You look at the first order term. Now comes the general principle. Always arrange it in such a form that if the eta, for instance, is the variation, that you get an integral of the form some kind of stuff times eta. And no d eta dt's or other derivatives of eta. It must be rearranged so it's always something times eta. You'll see the great value of that in a minute, but let's rearrange it. How can I rearrange this? It doesn't say it's not eta, it's d eta dt. I can do that by integrating by parts. And it turns out that the whole subject consists of writing this down and then integrating by parts so that the derivatives disappear. It's always the same. And every problem, it's always the same. And here we have the general principle for integrating by parts. If you have any function times d eta dt dt, which is f d eta, see, then you can integrate by parts by a rule, which works like this. Because the derivative of f eta with respect to t is f d eta dt plus eta df dt. And when you integrate that formula, you get this rule. All right, you know how to integrate by parts. Perhaps you don't ever saw it with eta's and f's. You might have seen it with x's and y. But here's the eta df dt dt. And so we have succeeded in getting into the integral of eta and stuff if we integrate by parts. In our application, the f is m times dx dt. And therefore, I have the following formula for delta s. First, f times eta integrated. That's mx dot. Oh, no, you don't know what x dot is. That's nonsense. M times dx dt times eta. And that's integrated. And that must be evaluated, therefore, at the two limits, t1 and t2. And that's what I mean by this bar here. I mean, evaluate this at those two limits. And then I must have the integral that I get from doing the bipartsy thing here, which is eta, left out, important point, eta of t times the derivative with respect to time of the f, which is m dx dt for us. And then I've carried down here this term without change, the last term. It's just the same thing again. Now comes something which always happens also. And that is that the integrated part disappears. Now, in our case here, in fact, if the integrated part doesn't disappear, you restate the principle so that you make sure it disappears. See, now the condition here is to make this disappear is that eta must be zero at both ends. And therefore, we know that the principle is that the thing is a minimum, provided that the curve begins and ends at the original points. That's how we find out. But actually, we know the condition eta t1 is zero, eta t2 is zero, that's zero. And here we then can collect these terms together and obtain this, that the shift in S is some stuff, all right, which is minus m times the second derivative of x with respect to t minus v prime of x, multiplied by eta of t dt, putting the integrals together into one. Now we have an integral of something or other times eta of t is always zero. All right, have this problem. I multiply some function of t by eta, and I integrate it from one end to the other, and no matter what the eta is, I get zero. That means the function is zero. You invent the proof. I'll show you a proof of a kind. I'm not very good at proving things, but here's a proof. Suppose that for the eta, we took something which was zero all along. Here's a t. It was zero, 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 and then it blipped up for a moment and blipped back down. Then when we did this integral, the only place you get anything other than zero was where this was blipping. And where this is blipping, you just get f times the integral over the blip. And that must be zero. The integral over the blip isn't zero, but the f has to be. So the f has to be zero everywhere, you see. Well, never mind. The f has to, if this integral is zero for any eta, then the integrand over this coefficient must be zero. And so we conclude that the thing will work, that it is a minimum, provided that the true path, that the minimum path satisfies a certain complicated differential equation, which you've seen before, which is f equals ma. Here's the mass times acceleration, or rather, yes, and here is the derivative of the potential, which is the force. So here, for a conservative system at least, we've demonstrated the principle of least action. And it shows that the path that has the minimum action is the one satisfying Newton's law. First remark, I didn't prove it was a minimum. It may be it's not a minimum. In fact, it doesn't have to be really a minimum. It's very analogous to our situation in the principle of least time, which we discussed in optics, in which, although at first we said it was least time, it turned out that there were situations in which it wasn't the least time, but that the fundamental principle was that the first order variation away, if you made a first order variation away from the optical path, the change in time was zero. Same story. What we really mean by least is that a first order change in the value, when you change the path to the first order, is zero. It's not necessarily a minimum. It's to be absolutely precise. Next, I remark on some generalizations. In the first place, the thing can be done in three dimensions. This is x, but you could have x, y, z as a function of t, and have an action which is more complicated. It turns out that for three-dimensional cases of the same kind, what you have is the complete kinetic energy, 1/2 of m times the rate of change with the the whole velocity squared, which is the sum of the components. It depends on what coordinate system you use. Let's say x, y, z, and this would be dx dt squared plus dy dt squared plus dz dt squared, and so on. And that the potential energy, then, is a function of x, y, and z. And what about the path? Then the path is a thing in space, which isn't so easily drawn on the blackboard, but the idea is the same. And what about the eta? Well, the eta can have three components. You could shift the x value of the pads, or the y value, or the z value. You could shift them all simultaneously. You can take a path in space and talk about another path in which is slightly different. And the eta would be a vector. However, since it's interesting, in small point, by the way, that since the variation first order has to be zero, only we can do the calculation by three successive shifts. We can shift only eta in the x direction and say that coefficient must be zero and get one equation, then shift it in the y direction and get another, and in the z and get another, or any other way that you want to do it. Anyway, you get three equations. And of course, Newton's laws are three equations in three dimensions, one for each component, and that's what happens. And I think you can practically see that it's bound to work, but we'll leave you to try to show for yourself that it will work if you have three dimensions. And furthermore, it can be generalized to any number of particles. If you have, see, two particles going around each other, like, or more, let's say two, with a force between them, so there's a potential energy between them, and they then, again, the situation is to take the kinetic energy, but this time of both particles added, and then the potential energy of mutual interaction. And what do you vary? You vary both particles. And you get then, for instance, in three dimensions for two particles, six equations. You can vary the position of this one in the x direction, the y direction, this one in the x, y, z. Six, but that's right, there are six equations. There's the three equations that determines the acceleration of the number one particle in terms of the force from two, and the acceleration of number two particle and the force from one. And that is not difficult. You follow the same game down, and you get Newton's laws in three dimensions for any number of particles. I said Newton's laws, it isn't quite true, because Newton's laws include non-conservative forces like friction. Newton said, just put F over here. It only works for conservative systems. We also know that on a microscopic level, at the deepest level of the physics, there's no non-conservative forces. They're all due to macroscopic complications. Friction is due to there being too many particles to analyze. But the fundamental laws are susceptible to be put in the form of a principle of least action. Let me generalize still further to tell you another few examples. What happens if the particle moves relativistically? In accordance to the theory of relativity, this thing is wrong. Question is there a corresponding principle of least action for the relativity case? And I write it down. There is. And I'll write it down. And the formula in the case of relativity is the following. M0, that's the rest mass, times c squared, times the integral from one time to the other of the square root of 1 minus the velocity squared over c squared, just a single particle, integrated with respect to time, is what is one term that can't, I mean, I can separate the integrals into more than one, of course. An integral of a difference is a separate integral, so I happen to have separated it. And then there's another term, which is the integral from T1 to T2, of any scalar potential that may be present. I talk now in the case when there's electrodynamics, when there's scalar potential present, and also in the magnetic field, to make a complete theory, a relativistic particle in electromagnetic field. Then you have this potential, which is a function of x, y, z, and t, of course, minus the velocity of the particle, dot, in a vector, dot, the x, y, z, and t, times dt. Now, all these velocities, you must substitute before you try to figure anything out, that, for instance, vx in the component has to be first replaced by dx dt, of course. And likewise, v square is the sum of the squares. And now, after you've made those replacements of the hidden v's, then you get a formula which is the action for a relativistic particle. I leave to the more ingenious of you the problem to demonstrate that this gives, in fact, the equations for relativity. May I suggest first that you do it without the A, without a magnetic field, and see if you can't get the analog of this, and see if you can't discover that down here is the 1 over that square root which belongs for the relativity case. Those only the most clever ones will succeed, including the case of the vector potential, because it's quite an elaborate finagling to get the equation. And when you're all finished, you'll find that the force on the other side of the equation is the electric field plus V cross the magnetic field. But we leave that to play with. One point, though, I would like to emphasize is that the general case, like this case here, is not in the form of the kinetic energy minus the potential energy anymore. That's only true in the non-relativistic approximation. In fact, incidentally, if you expand this square root out, you'll get a certain constant that doesn't vary with the path, plus 1/2 from the square root. V squared over C squared cancels that. You get M naught V squared over 2, and you get the other theory. But this is not the kinetic energy, and it depends on how you define it. At any rate, it's in this term definitely not. It's not the kinetic minus the potential in general. It's just for the simplest example that it's that. The question of what it is in each case is a question that only must be determined by some kind of trial and error. It's just the same problem as determining what are the laws of motion in the first place in an electric and magnetic field. So you just fiddle around with the equations that you know and see if you can get it in the form of least action. One other point, just a terminology. This thing is in the form of L dt, an integral of something or other, this L depending on the velocities and the positions and so on, from one time to the other. And just because you may happen to hear the word somewhere and think I thought I was taught everything in the freshman and sophomore class, just to complete it so that you're not frightened, this terrible quantity, which in this formula is the square root plus phi plus v dot a, is called the Lagrangian of the system. All right. That's just a word. It doesn't make any difference. Furthermore, this S is not really called to action by the most precise and pedantic people. It is called Hamilton's first principle function. Now, I hate to give a lecture on the principle of least Hamilton's first principle function. That's no good. No. So I therefore call it the action, and more people are calling it the action. See, historically, something else was called the action, which is not quite as useful as this. And so just let's call it the action. And you'll see by the time you, because of effects like my own, you too will call it the action, and pretty soon everybody will call it by a simple name. Okay. We don't want to call it Hamilton's first principle function. Now I will make some discussions on this subject, which are the same as the discussions that we made with the principle of least time. There's quite a difference in characteristic of a law which says a certain integral from one place to the other is a minimum, which tells something about the whole path, and a law in which you say, as you go along, here's a force, that makes it accelerate, that makes it a force, that makes it accelerate. One is a piddle way of going along, and the other is a grand discussion of the whole curve. In the case of light, we just talked about the connection of these two, and I would like to explain why it is true that there are differential laws when there's a least action principle of this kind. And the answer is the following. Consider the actual orbit or path in space and time, so the same diagram as before, say one dimension, and that the true path is this one for which the situation is a minimum. Then I'd like to point out something. Let's suppose that the true path starting from 1 and going to 2 passes through a point A in space and time, and another very nearby point, say, or any other point, doesn't make any difference, nearby or otherwise, B. Now, if the entire integral from here to here is a minimum, it's necessary that even the little section in here be a minimum. It can't be that the part from here to here is a little bit more than it could be less than, or something, because otherwise you just fiddle with this and change it and make the whole answer lower. So therefore, even a subsection of the path must also be a minimum, and this is true no matter how short the subsection. Therefore, the principle that the whole path can be minimum can be stated also by saying that an infinitesimal section of path also has a curve such that it's a minimum action. Now, if we take a short enough section of path, the fact that the points are very close together in space, and the fact that the potential varies from place to place is not essential because you're staying almost in the same place over the whole path. The only thing you have to discuss is the first correction to the potential. The fact the potential varies a little bit here. It only, therefore, depends on the derivative of the potential and not on the potential everywhere. And it's not a... We've changed from a gross property of the whole path to a little statement of what happens for a short section of path, a differential statement, and this differential statement only involves the derivatives of the potentials. And that's what, of course, comes out. But that's just qualitative explanation of how the relation between the gross law and the differential law. Now, in the case of light, we also discussed the question, how did the particle find the path? From the differential point of view, philosophically, it's much easier. Every moment it gets an acceleration, it knows only what to do at that instant. But all your instincts on cause and effect and everything else go haywire when you say that the particle decides on which path is going to give the minimum action. Does it, as we said before, smell the neighboring paths to find out whether or not they have more action? And in the case of light, we put blocks in the way so that they couldn't test all the paths and found out that they couldn't figure out which way to go, and we had the phenomenon of diffraction. Is the same thing true in mechanics? Does it true that the particle not only does it does this, it looks at this path, looks at all the other trajectories, and if we don't let it look by having things in the way, it can't go through narrow slits and so forth, that we'll get an analog of diffraction. The miracle of it all is of course, that we do. And that the quantum mechanical laws are just that, that this principle of least action is incompletely stated. It isn't that it takes the path of least action, but that it smells all the paths in the neighborhood, and it chooses that which has the least action by a method analogous to the way that the light chose the shortest time. You remember that the way that the light chose the shortest time was this, that if it went on a path that had a different amount of time, when it arrived here, it would arrive at a different phase. And if we add a contribution of amplitude for all the different ways the light can arrive, then if we have a lot of different phases to be added together, we add a lot of, say, for one path, we get a contribution, another path, they're all different phases, they don't amount to anything. But if you can find a whole sequence of paths which are very close to, which have the phases almost all the same, then these little contributions will at last add up, and you get a reasonable total amplitude to arrive. So the important path becomes the one for which there are nearby paths which give the same phase. Just exactly the same thing is the quantum mechanical principle, and it is the following. The complete quantum mechanics works as follows, in non-relativistic limit only, in the non-relativistic theory, without spin and a couple of other things. Well, that's all, just without spin and non-relativistic. Your following is true, that the probability to arrive from starting a particle at point one, the probability to arrive at two, starting at a definite time t1, the probability to arrive at another place in the time t2 is the square of an amplitude. We've discussed that. This amplitude is the probability amplitude to arrive. Now, the amplitude to arrive, the total amplitude we could call it to arrive, can be written as a sum of amplitude for each path, for each way of arrival. Now, what each way of arrival now is a very complete thing. For every x of t that you have, for every possible imaginary trajectory, because we're never going to decide which one it actually takes, you know all that stuff. But for each possible path, x of t, we have to calculate an amplitude, and then we add that together for all the paths. Now the answer, now we can see right away what the amplitude for a single path ought to be. The amplitude is proportional to, or I could say sort of constant normalization, constant something, times e to the I h times the action, s for that path. That is, the phase is proportional to the action. It's a complex number to represent that phase, e to the I, this is the angle, s over h. S has dimensions of energy times time, and we need a unit of dimensions, and this unit determines when quantum mechanics is important. And that unit is Planck's constant, h, and as the energy times time is the units of it. If the s is very large compared to h, then here's what happens. Some path contributes a certain amplitude. A nearby path, since the S's are so enormous, even a small change in the S means a completely different phase because the H is so tiny. So a path and a nearby path cancel their effects out in taking the sum. except for one region, and that is when the path and a nearby path all give the same phase in the first approximation. Then those paths will be the important ones. And so in the limiting case in which the H of Planck's constant goes to zero, the correct quantum mechanical laws can be summarized by simply saying, well, forget about all these probability amplitudes and all that stuff. Just say the particle does go on a special path, namely that one in which the S doesn't vary in first approximation when you vary the path. And that's the relation between the principle of least action and the quantum mechanics. The fact that quantum mechanics can be formulated in this way, quantum mechanics was originally formulated by giving a differential equation for the amplitude and also by some more other matrix mechanics, the fact that it can be formulated in this particular way in terms of the action was discovered by a student of that same teacher, Bader. Now I give an example of another. The question is, are there other minimum principles in physics? There are many minimum principles in physics, and they're all very interesting ones. There are so many of them that I thought, rather than give a summary here, I'll only give one more, and then perhaps when we come to them, physical phenomena which have a nice minimum principle, I'll tell about it at each time. So we'll only give one more example of a completely different, at first sight anyway, a different minimum principle. You see, this isn't a question of least action, but it's another kind of a statement, like describing a circle by saying it's the curve which has the most area for a given perimeter. I will now describe electrostatics, not by giving an equation, but by telling you that a certain integral is a maximum or a minimum. Here's the integral. First, let's take the case where you know what the charge density is, and the problem is to find the potential phi, and that they have all of space to go into. I mean, we don't have any boundaries. So you know the answer is that the answer should be Laplacian phi minus rho over epsilon 0. But another way of stating it is this. Calculate the integral, I or whatever you want to call it, epsilon 0 over 2 times the integral of the gradient of phi squared over the whole volume in space. Take away the integral of rho times phi d volume. If there were no charge, this would be the energy in the field. Now I say that this thing is a minimum for the correct potential method of proof. Let's suppose that the phi is the correct potential plus a correction to show that when we make the substitution of the correct potential plus the correction, that to the first order, the change in I is zero. Well, you put it in here. I go just a little bit faster because we're running out of time. Well, here, the gradient of phi is the gradient of phi underline plus the gradient of f. Phi underline is what we're looking for, but we're making it with a variation to see what happens and that the first correction must be zero. When I square that, I get the gradient of phi bar squared. Now, that's going to be the old one. And so just to save me a little time, please, let's take away right away all those terms which come, just the old one, and look at the first order term. When I square this, I get the old one square, plus the product of the two. That's the one that I'm looking for, times two. So I have gradient of phi dot gradient of f, plus gradient of f square, higher order, forget it. All right, now over here I have rho phi bar, but that's part of the old I bar. I'm rho f, okay, rho f. Very good. D volume, D volume. Okay, gain. General rule, got to get the darn thing all clear of derivatives. Here we're not clear of derivatives. Look at what this is. This starts d phi bar dx, that's the x component times the x component, plus the y component times the y component, and so forth. And then we have to integrate with respect to x, to y, and the z. Integrate by parts with respect to x. That will carry the derivative over onto the phi. The same general idea as with the t, only with x. And change the sign. And produce some junk, which is the integrated stuff, which is going to be zero. And if it isn't, you change the rules. And so what happens out of this term, I suppose let's push the board up now, but I can't. What happens to this term here is that you get the second derivative of phi bar with respect to x times f with a minus sign. And that happens not only with respect to the x, but the y and the z also. So you get Laplacian phi times f, d volume, minus integral of rho, f d volume, or collecting all the integrals together, it's the integral, minus epsilon naught Laplacian phi minus rho, f d volume, rho. In order for this to be zero for any f, no matter what, in any place in space, and then the dull coefficient must be zero, and therefore Laplacian phi must be equal to rho over epsilon naught with a minus sign. That is, this is the equation of the correct solution. So here is a proposition which is correct. The method of transforming this into this, that is to transform the product of the gradients into f times the Laplacian, we did it by hand. I could show you a little bit cleverer way than to do it by hand, which is the following, just in case you want. We have to have d phi dot df was what we're trying to calculate. And although it isn't obvious why, I'm going to look on the side and I'm going to calculate this quantity. If I differentiate this out, I can show you that this is del f del phi minus plus f Laplacian phi. And this is the principle by which we can integrate this by parts. We write this on the other side. Now, I substitute that in here. So I get the divergence of f gradient phi integrated with respect to volume minus the integral of Laplacian phi times f. This is the piece we wanted. And this, what happened to it? A volume of a integral of a divergence is the same thing as the integral over the surface of the normal component. So if we suppose that even now we can do a case when there are surfaces, suppose that there are surfaces, conductors, in which we hold the potential fixed and given, so that when we vary the thing, we don't vary, f is zero on the surface of the conductors because f is the change in potential. We don't change that. Then this will be zero because all this integral is over the volume. If we make the integral over the volume interior, not up to, but not including the conductors, then the surface of that volume are the conductors where f is zero. So we have another case. Even if rho is zero, for instance, we have another simple example. In the case where there are conductors set at certain potentials that are given, then the potential in the interior adjusts itself so that this integral is least without that. And what's this integral? That's the square of the electric field. That's just the energy inside. So I use this to show you how to calculate. I would like to use this to calculate something to show you that these things are very practical. What we have just discovered is this, that if we have a set of conductors, and I'm going to take a cylindrical condenser for my pair of conductors, the two conductors, and the inside is at potential V, the outside is potential 0, the inside has radius A, the outside has radius B. And if we suppose any distribution of potential from here to here, and calculate epsilon naught over 2 times the integral of the gradient of phi squared d volume, which incidentally would be the energy in the system, 1/2 CV squared. But if we use the wrong distribution of potential and calculate the capacity by this method, we'll get a capacity that's too big. Only the exactly correct potential phi will give the fake capacity, which we calculate by putting fake phis in. The true phi will give the least possible C. How do I use that? I make it very easy. I suppose, for instance, that the potential corresponds to a constant field. You know the field isn't constant in here. It varies as 1 over R, which the field varies as 1 over R. I'm approximated sloppily with a constant. A field which is constant means a potential which goes linearly with distance, and after some mental effort, you can find that this potential has the property that it's V on the inner surface when R equals A, and it's zero on the outer surface when R equals B, and that the field corresponding is a constant, and that the field or the gradient of phi is a radial field and is V over B minus A. So what one does is put in here epsilon 0 over 2 integral of V over B minus A squared times the volume, which is 2 pi r dr times the length. Let's do this calculation for a cylinder of unit length, or per unit length, the capacity. This is a constant, and RDR integrated from B to A is easy. It's just B, pi B squared minus A squared over B minus A squared. So I have a formula for the capacity, which is not the true one, 1 over log B over A, but is an approximate slop job, which is B plus A over B minus A. That's because B squared minus A squared has a B minus A factor. Anyway, that's what I got by this quick trick, without knowing the field at all, just guessing. And here are the results of the true capacity and the first approximation. Even when B over A is as big as 2, which is a pretty big variation in the field, a 2-to-1 variation in the field that I've assumed constant, nevertheless, I get a fair approximation, of course, a little too high, as expected, but some good approximation. As the thing gets much worse, for instance, if you have a tiny wire, 1 centimeter in a meter thing, and the field goes ping, and you represent it by a constant, you're not doing very well. You're off by nearly a factor of 2. But you do much better the closer it gets. To take the opposite extreme, when they're not very far apart, just 10% apart, then the constant field is a pretty good approximation, and we get the correct value to within 0.1%. Now, if you'll just bear with me, I ordinarily do finish exactly on the right time, but just give me 2 minutes now, a little extra, because I haven't got another lecture to tack it on to. I would like to say an important point on how to improve such a calculation. The next step, you might say, of course, you know the right answer for the cylinder, but for some other problem, you may not know the right answer. The next step is to suppose that it's not linear, but quadratic, that the field is not constant, but linear, or that the potential, I should, of course, use a curve like that the potential is not just a linear term, but has also got a quadratic term. And so I have a formula of this nature. This is a formula which is a little more complicated. It involves a quadratic term in the potential as well as a linear term, a little bit more complicated. And it's very easy to get the field out of here. The field is just V times alpha over B minus A minus 1 plus alpha times R minus A over B minus A squared times 2 or something like that. And square that and integrate. Now, how did I get this business? This coefficient is so chosen that the potential is 0 on the outside and V on the inside. But I still can't determine alpha. That's the trouble. What should I take? I can take a parabola for the E, but what parabola? What's alpha? And here's how you do that. Calculate the capacity with this, with an arbitrary alpha. If you want to actually check me and try it, and you want an intermediate step, I'll give you the capacity that I got for arbitrary alpha, and I got C over 2 pi epsilon naught came out to be A over B minus A, and it looks a little complicated, but it's nothing but integrating the square of the field, and it's alpha squared over 6 plus 2 alpha over 3 plus 1. It's a straightforward and relatively simple calculation. It just, so, comes out. Now, how do I pick alpha? Now, the story is this. I know that the truth lies lower than anything I'm going to calculate. So whatever alpha I put in here, I'm going to get an answer too big. But if I keep playing with alpha, and I get the lowest possible value I can get by finagling around with alpha, that lowest value is nearer to the truth than any other value, right? Because it's all above. And so what I next do is I vary this with respect to alpha and take a minimum. And it turns out that that means that alpha is 2b over b plus a with a minus sign. It turns out that the minimum of this occurs here. And then substituting that minimum value in to the formula, I obtain this result for the capacity. And now I would like to write down the numerical answers that I got. For example, for the case 2 in this thing, I had 1444, which is a very good one. As we go up, it stays pretty good. It's much, much better than the first approximation. It's even fairly good. It's only off by 10%, or less, rather, even when the ratio is 10 to 1. But when it gets to be 100 to 1, okay, things begin to go wild. It's 3.64 instead of 2.6. On the other hand, when the thing should be good, it's very, very good. 4667, which is excellent. And then this baby, when it's only 0.1, came out 492065 instead of 4.10492070. I gave these examples first to show the theoretical value of principles of minimum action and minimum principles, and second, to show their practical utility, not to calculate just the condenser where we know the logarithm, but any other shape. You can guess an approximate field with some unknown parameters like alpha in it and adjust them to get a minimum and get excellent numerical results for otherwise intractable problems. Thank you very much. Did you follow that one?
Another jackpot.
No?
Not entirely.
Uh-huh. But that such a thing exists, I guess, is all we needed. Yeah.
You must have had an excellent teacher.
Yeah, he knew when to shut up, as I said. Yeah, you had a very good teacher.
Knew with whom to shut up.
I had a very good teacher. What happened was that it was during the war, and during the Depression, and the poor man was trying to go to Columbia to get a math degree, a PhD degree in math, and he couldn't make it financially, so he spent part of his time teaching.
I see.
And so at least you had a guy who knew something, You know, usually you can't find a guy in a high school that can tell you something like that.
That's a pity, too.
No, he knew something. He was excellent for me, because that was one thing he did. But then another time, he said to me, after class I came down, he says to me, listen, he says, you make too much noise in class, you're always talking. So I felt bad, because he says, but I know why. He says, because you find it completely boring. Yes, which way is the light bent? And there's only two ways, taller away than the normal, and the odds are 90% you get it wrong, the student, you know. And you sit there and wait for him to say, light is bent, and so on. So he says, yeah, you know. So he said to me, but I don't want you to talk anymore. I'm going to give you a book. He said, you know too much. He says, I'm going to give you a book. You go way up in the back, and you read this book. And when you're satisfied you don't want the X in here, then you can start talking again. So he gave me a book, Wood's Advanced Calculus. Advanced Calculus. I had to learn the calculus plus advanced calculus. And I had a hell of a good time in the physics class, working up in the back, learning all the mathematical things, you know. That was very good. And he told me other things like this. It was very, I was lucky. Yeah.
Where did you go to school?
At a high school called Far Rockaway High School in New York City.
New York City.
Yeah.
You evidently did not consider it important to mention one thing, which was why I learned the calculus of gravitation.
About the minute? No, I know that one, but I hadn't any time.
No.
What?
About the fact that that you can use any coordinates.
Oh, I did have that. I had that in there too. I don't have enough time.
Yeah.
I had solved the motion of an ellipse.
I see.
Why don't we try another one, the planetary orbits, and I got the ellipse. I had it all, but you can't do too much. It's too much stuff. I can't do it. I can't do it. I was going to do that to show that it didn't depend on the coordinates, and I was going to do, I had some, I had also the hot and cold, this business about the entropy. Listen, I had an interesting thing. You know the heat flow, heat flow, you do,
yes.
Because each equation has its analog, like electricity has its analog.
Right.
I wanted to say all this. So that the analog of electrostatic minimum
generation of entropy
has an analog for heat flow. And in the case of heat flow, it's the rate of the loss, the gain of entropy per second is the least. Yes. And then I had noticed that when I was doing some research on mobility of electrons in a crystal, when we were doing it, where we had the Boltzmann equation for the distribution of velocities of the electrons, I found by accident, I normally start to look for one, but quickly I calculate, I found the minimum principle. for the Boltzmann equation. And we put it in, and it makes it easier to make calculations the same way and get high accuracy, you know, from lousy approximations. It's a very good thing. So I calculated using it. And the boys I were working with, I said, this must be known, so find our reference. So they found a reference. Of course, it was known, but I didn't know it. I just found it. And then, while I was preparing this lecture, which I wanted to say the types of variational principles, they're either derivable from the original mechanical one, or they belong in the quantum mechanics, or they're analog ones, or maybe this, I thought to myself, this idea of the entropy is generalizable. And I had this other X principle, and I found out the following. Not only are the currents so that the entropy rate is a maximum, but the distribution of the velocities of each of the electrons. See, the Maxwell distribution is the distribution at equilibrium. But when there's a current present, the electrons have a different distribution. In fact, they have to have a little current. They have to have it. If you calculate what distribution of the electrons would have to have, so as to give a mean current in a block of material, and at the same time adjust themselves so that the rate at which they chaos is generated, heat is generated, entropy is generated, is least, then that gives the correct distribution of the electrons. And I didn't know that, but I looked it up recently. I looked up the references and chased it back, and it was discovered in 1948 by a man named Kohler. However, as far as I know, it's not known for the quantum mechanical case, nor do I know if such a minimum principle exists. So I'm going to work on the situation where you do the motion of the electrons by quantum mechanics and prove again that the quantity of the rate of which the entropy goes to a minimum is a... See, when we calculated the mobility, we were looking for a minimum principle. And in fact, my paper says in it, we suspect very strongly that there's a minimum principle for the mobility in quantum mechanics, but we couldn't find it. Now I know the physical thing to look for, the rate of change of the entropy for a given current. I'm going to look and see if I can't find a minimum principle for it. So one thing may have come out of all these lectures.
Yeah, that I will have to say it is a pleasure to acknowledge my indebtedness to the sophomore class.
Yeah, for making me think about principles of minimum principles. Yeah. Yes. Today I'll be here at about 2:30, thereabouts. Yes, sir. You want this machine, sir?
Yeah.